Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining the conversation. This is Conversations from the Diaspora, a Building Africa's Future podcast. And as usual, I'm your host, your sister, and your friend in Kiru. And tonight, I'm joined by a very special guest. His name is Mr. Uwem Akpan. He is from Akwa Ibom State in Nigeria. His short stories and autobiographical pieces have appeared in The New Yorker, as well as the Oprah magazine and other notable places. His first book, Say You're One of Them, was a New York Times and Wall Street Journal number one bestseller and has been translated into 12 different languages. So, Mr. Uwem, if you could please just say hello to our listeners.
Hello, Nkiru. Hello to our listeners. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for reading my book, my books, if I may say.
Yes, thank you. And I definitely want to thank you again, you know, for coming on to the podcast. As you and I both know, this interview has been long overdue. And just as I was telling you earlier, I discovered your work sometime last year. I was in the process of, I just finished recording an audiobook for one of my friends. And, you know, that kind of inspired me to, you know, connect with African authors who wrote about the Nigerian or let's say the African immigrant experience. And that's how I, you know, which is what my podcast is all about. And then that's how I saw one of your books, Say You're One of Them. And I read an excerpt online, then I was moved to contact your publicist. And that's when I found out about your upcoming book, you know, this one that we're talking about tonight, the New York, My Village. And I just thought that your titles, you know, are really captivating. And I wanted to ask you, how do you manage to come up with such intriguing titles? And what was your inspiration for writing this novel?
Thanks again, Kiru. I have lived on and off this country since 1993. And there were lots of things about America and immigrants I've always wanted to talk about. What does it mean for people like us to come from our country, Nigeria, and get here? A lot of us are very successful out here in the US and in the West. As a demographic, we are doing very well in terms of education, getting good jobs, but we have challenges. What does it mean? What does it take to break into, you know, America and be conversant with the culture of America? And how do you sustain your own culture, which you have brought from, you know, from home? So this conflict, you know, racism, even stuff like trying to relate with African Americans. When I came, I took that for granted. Relating with other demographics, Asian Americans, Latino Americans, Native Americans, and what have you. So, but also I've always wanted to write about the Biafran War from the perspective of the minorities of the Niger Delta. And what the world knows, you know, is that Biafra was just the Igbos. The world does not know that there were 30 minority groups, ethnic groups, at least in Biafra. So I've always wanted to write about this war from that perspective. It's missing in the storytelling, the stories of this war. It's missing in, you know, Nigerian history, the place of, you know, minorities. So we always talk about the Igbos, the Hausas, the Yorubas. These are huge ethnic groups of not less than 30 million people. So it's no coincidence that they dominate the Nigerian narrative. So these were my inspirations for writing New York, my village.
Yes, I mean, that's really beautiful, even the way you described it. And I think for a lot of us as immigrants to this country, of course, my experience is different from yours because I came here as a child, so I'm very much socialized as an American, but, you know, I still hold on to a lot of my, you know, traditional cultural upbringing. And I think, you know, one thing in particular about the title, New York, My Village, when most people, you know, from back home, wherever that might mean for our, you know, our listeners, when they see or when they see like the U.S. or think of the United States from like the perspective of what we see in the media, it's always this glamorized kind of beautiful, like once you get here, your life will just automatically change for the better. I think for many immigrants, when we have our understanding of the United States is typically from the standpoint of, you know, whatever we see in the media, especially like New York is always kind of like the idealized maybe image of the U.S. And then like once you get here, you see for yourself that this is not exactly what you expected. So given my own experience personally, I was recently in New Jersey. Well, I was there for a little while for grad school. For me, I've always kind of viewed the North to be this kind of rough place, if you want to call it that. But, you know, for other immigrants who, let's say that's their first interaction or their first encounter with the U.S., mm-hmm. I would say it's a striking culture shock. I'll give my husband as an example. When he first came to the U.S., he was living in New Jersey, and he told his sister, he was like, this place looks a lot like Lagos. So, you know, you just kind of see a lot of very similarities, of a very similar kind of maybe people, like kind of the hustle and bustle, like especially depending on the environment that you're in, this kind of like rough looking. I mean, of course, not every place is like that, but those are the places you don't see on TV when you're, you know, back home in Nigeria or wherever. So, and I love the fact that, you know, in your book, like in the cover, like before, like there was like some images that you put in where it's, you have New York City broken down into smaller villages or ethnic enclaves, if you will, mm-hmm. showing different different groups of people represented in their villages, so to speak. And then you also paralleled that on the other page with, you know, the Nigerian region and those groups that, you know, we're going to talk about later on in this conversation. So I actually just wanted to introduce our listeners a little bit, you know, to the main character in the book, Ekong. I don't know how he say his last name.
Udosara.
Okay, Udosara, thank you.
Yes.
So kind of like what I was saying earlier, like how he was exposed to the rough side of, you know, New York City, which again is vastly different from all these images that we're used to seeing. And then, you know, one thing that I thought was quite outstanding was, which, you know, again, we'll discuss this a little bit more later, how Ekong become, he's from an ethnic minority in Nigeria, the Anang people in the Delta region. And mm-hmm. now he's also part of another cultural or ethnic minority once he comes to the U.S. So he's
yes.
a minority in his home country and also a minority yeah. of a minority, you know, while he's here in the U.S. So yeah. I guess my question or my questions from that is, how much would you say of Ekong's character is based on your personal experiences as an immigrant to this country? And I know you mentioned that a little bit, but if you can just kind of expound a little bit more.
Yeah, some of it, obviously, you know, some of it would based on, you know, things I have heard, experienced. But again, I set my imagination free. While I have lived in New York for a year, I have never worked in publishing. I say this because a lot of people are like, wow, you've really captured this publishing. How long did you work in publishing? I said, none. No. I've never worked in publishing. One thing I want to say immediately is I always try to make my writing feel memoirish. Write as if I experienced every bit of this. So if you read my collection of short stories, you will see the same thing. And when An Extra's Feast first came out, a lot of people thought I was a street kid in Kenya. And I spent time explaining to them, no, I was never a street kid in Kenya or in Nigeria. Then my parents' bedroom came out, and many people thought I was from Rwanda. So I said, I have never even been to Rwanda. And the last time I looked, I was a guy, not a girl, because the narrator in the so I work very hard to make it feel very real. So what I'm saying to you is, even in those stories, like my parents' bedroom set in Rwanda, a place I've never been to, even up till now, I'm still trying to figure out how to go and visit Rwanda. I still write as if I experienced this. I also do a lot of research. Like I speak to people in publishing, I speak to Latinos, I speak to Native Americans. I have friends from all over. It was the same thing with the Biafran War stories. I have a lot of Igbo friends who, God bless them, came to believe, yes, the minority stories have to be told too. And so they helped me a lot with research, especially in Igbo land. And when I went to Igbo land to research, I could count on them to protect me from, how people can be upset that, you're coming to figure out this kind of stuff. So all of these things come into my, my writing. I've always also wanted to write about racism in the church. I was a Catholic priest. I ministered to white folks, Latinos, Asian Americans. I mean, as a priest, you get invited to different homes and get a sense of how people are grappling with these issues, and what you can do to help. So that's how far I would go. It's tempting for many people to think Ekong Odoh Osora is Uwemakpan. But it's not. There are some parts of work on Odoh Osora that have benefited from my life experiences. But he's a different character. I don't have that kind of patience and resilience. Ekong Odoh Osora throughout the book. He's only Anang because I wanted to talk about the Anangs, and I'm an Anang person. When I at a point I wanted to make him a woman, I wanted it to make him a woman, but I really wanted to, for the bed bug story, the final painful scene in the bed bug story. Women don't have that kind of equipment on their bodies, and it would have been very difficult to figure out how to make that very painful in the situation of women. So I decided to stay with, with men. So there were a lot of tactical, technical decisions I had to make, throughout. Yeah. Let me stop rambling.
No.
Talk.
Well, I do want to kind of go back to that question about, or the notion about, being a so-called minority amongst minorities. And the only reason why I say so-called, it's for some reason, I don't have like the, I don't really like that word. I feel like it's a very, has a very negative connotation, but for the purpose of this conversation, I would like to use that. So how would you say that, Ekong's experience as a minority amongst minorities helped or influenced, you know, his thinking or the way he related with Americans, or let's say specifically African Americans or Latinos and other cultural groups that he encountered?
Yes, when you are a minority of minorities, you're not only afraid of racism, you're not only afraid of how white people will treat you, you're also afraid of how your fellow blacks will treat you, because you don't have any comfort in numbers. So it's a difficult place to be in. Let me put it this way, Nkiru. When you show up, your ethnic group is already well known worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So things fall apart. The brilliant, the Igbos are blessed with powerful, brilliant writers. And you guys have made a lot of name worldwide. So, someone would say, are you Yoruba? You say no. Are you Hausa? You say no. You must be Igbo. You say yes.
Yeah.
And if they're in doubt, it's easy to say, have you read Things Fall Apart?
Mm-hmm.
I said, have you read Chimamanda? Do you know of Chimamanda? I say yes. So you have this referent points or people to point to. When they ask me, are you Igbo? I say no. Are you Yoruba? I say no. When are you Hausa? I said, they changed the conversation. It's like I'm not Nigerian. They do not know that there are 250 or is it 300
or more? Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah. So to be in that, so you are constantly trying to actually define who you are. The majorities don't have to think about this. The minority has to think of, okay, how do I make myself visible? And it's not just as simple as Africa is not a country. And we like to say this to white people. Yeah, they need to learn all of this. But in Kiru, myself and others, what do we know about the tribes of Cameroon? See what I mean?
Mm.
Someone asked me, how many tribes are there in Cameroon? Can you name five? I got no idea. If someone asked me, what are the tribes of, Benin Republic or Togo? I'm not even going far, like, say, Kenya. I have no idea what's happening there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know Kenya on the map. They're closer to, I've even lived there for 3 years. But if someone is going to really ask me about Kenya, I would have no idea what is actually happening there. So it's very diverse. And when you're a minority, you have a lot of conversations in your head, like a condoser.
Mm-hmm.
Every small thing, you are running the consequences, the possibilities through so many, so many filters to know, okay, how do I play the politics? How do I get this right? Okay. And it would be the same thing if you have one woman working in a company that has, 50 or 60 or 70, men working there.
Right.
It's going to be very difficult for that woman, because she's got to figure out, okay, who are my friends here?
Mm-hmm.
When we sit at these board meetings, okay, who are my allies?
Right. Okay.
That kind of stuff. So Ekong He's going through this in the publishing industry. He's going through this in where he lives, in Hell's Kitchen. He's going through this, you know, relating with the African-American guy he lives with, okay? So it's not easy for, you know, for minorities. You have too many conversations in your head at any time.
Yes, yes, definitely. Actually, I was going to push that question a little bit towards the end, but since we brought it up, I wanted to ask, what would you say, I guess, alternatively, what can be done to, because I know as far as representation, that's something that we hear a lot, you know, in the media and everything else, like representation matters. You know, we have to write our own stories, which of course, that's what you're doing. But I think even given the context of what you said, as far as the Igbo people or Nigerians as a whole, you know, when I first came to this country, I came here, you know, 96 as a child, growing up in the school system, which is something I talk about quite often on my podcast. You know, for many of us who grew up in the 90s, early 2000s, we did not see, you know, being an African wasn't as cool or as amazing or trendy as it is now. It definitely took some work. It definitely, and again, thank goodness for social media. Social media has really pushed, you know, Africa, particularly Nigeria, of course, on a global map with the music, with the culture, with the food, weddings especially. And then also for, you know, the millennial generation, I would say that a lot of us are doing a lot when it comes to trying to, you know, learn our native tongues, you know, our mother languages and everything like that. So I think, I guess my question is what would it take for, you know, other groups in Nigeria, ethnic or cultural minorities to find their place, so to speak, when they, you know, are trying to fit in on a global stage, either, you know, on a national level, like within Nigeria, or, you know, internationally, you know, in the US or any other place. What would you say as far as that?
Yeah. I mean, it comes down to education. For example, Nigeria has, you know, Nigeria refused to teach history, you know, in schools, for public schools, you know, for what, 30 years? That kind of thing cannot help anybody. Right. So they should, in Nigeria, they should stop that nonsense. And begin to teach history.
I know.
Yeah. They should. So in the absence of, you know, history as history, we now rely too much on fiction as history. See? Wow.
That's deep.
Yeah. So that's the problem there. There are so many people who read half of the Yellow Sun and they're like, yes, this is exactly what happened. You see? They forget that it's a work of fiction, historical fiction, but fiction nonetheless. There are many people who are reading my book now. And yes, that's exactly what happened. They forget that it's fiction, historical fiction, fiction nonetheless. Why I point this out is this. If you find yourself absent from these fictional books that stand in for histories, you'll be very angry with yourself. But if we're teaching history in schools, and, you know, we get to celebrate the diversity and we know about each other and we project this out there, then if you are left out of some narrative, you would not be too angry. You see?
Yeah.
So that's something to do within the Nigerian space. Let's go back to teaching history, you know, in high school. We may not like what history is showing us, but we cannot just throw history out. What are we doing? Okay. So again, in Nigeria, that's, you know, what to do. Out here, the beauty of our diaspora community is actually in the things you've already mentioned, that we are able to, we have the resources. Education is not working right now within Nigeria, as you know. You know, many things are not working right now as they should. But some of us who have come out here, we are educated, we have the intellectual resources, we have the space, we have the tools. So we are engaging this sort of stuff on social media and projecting, showing our food, showing our weddings, showing who we are. It's very important. And again, you brought something up that is very beautiful to highlight here. Many of our diaspora children are beginning to learn their native languages. Okay? Right. And how are they doing this? Some of them are finding programs online.
Yes.
How did these programs come to be online? Because their fellow diaspora people knew this was a necessity, and they developed this and put online. So these are the things we have to keep, you know, keep doing.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely agree with that. And even to that point, because we see that there's a need, so kind of just giving myself as an example, you know, I grew up hearing hearing Igbo in the home, you know, like I guess the average diaspora child, as you just referred to us as, you know, if you ask them, oh, do you speak your language? The first thing you'll hear them say is, oh, I can hear it, but I can't speak it. Yes. So that, so even like in the last, let's say, 7 to 10 years, you know, looking for these resources to learn the language, you would probably just see like a few books here and there that were very obscure. Like, because when I traveled to Nigeria, I think that was back in 2013, I randomly found an Igbo workbook in like one market one day. But now, you know, if I go on Amazon, I'll see so many Igbo books, I'll see so many Igbo teachers and language courses and everything. So I'm really happy that, you know, people are pushing for this, you know, because it's a clear need. It's a clear thing that, you know, we desire it. We want to have this connection, because for many of us, like some of us who were born here or people like me who grew up here, don't really have much of a connection to their home countries outside of, you know, their name and, you know, just their home life, upbringing and everything else like that. So that actually kind of, I would like to kind of go quickly to, you know, one part of your story when you talked about Ekong trying to Americanize his food when he was inviting his friends over for Thanksgiving. And I thought that was both funny and sad at the same time, because it clearly reflects this thing that, you know, we just discussed now, how for many of us, you know, using myself as an example again, you know, when we were growing up, you know, we were teased about our names and different things about our culture. Yeah. And like, so many of us, you know, try to Americanize our names or our cultures when we're explaining it to our classmates. We try to figure out a way to make it sound American. My dad was very stubborn in the sense that he didn't want any of us to bear English names. And I know that's one thing that kind of, you know, going back to what you said about history and the way our people view culture and tradition, many of our people kind of see it in a very negative or very primitive kind of light, and they try their best not to speak to their kids in their native languages, or try to give them, you know, English names, or, you know, European, or if you want to call it Christian names, or whatever that might mean. So I really wanted to talk about how, you know, how much things have changed again, like how, you know, we're valuing our cultural heritage. We're putting it on the forefront when it comes to, you know, trying to speak the language, even pidgin, like trying to let people know. Like, and I even think about like Jamaican patois. Like most people, they probably have never, you know, been to Jamaica, but because they hear reggae music, or because Jamaicans, like, we see how, you know, proud they are of their culture, like, most people can pick up, like, a few words. Like, if they hear their music, they know what they're saying, they know their food, they know, like, they're very familiar with, you know, Jamaica. Yeah, but, you know, I think for many of us on you know, Africans, continental Africans, it wasn't until recently that we are trying to do that, but, and even still, it's not, you know, all over the continent. But yeah, I just wanted you to kind of maybe talk a little bit more about that, if you could.
Yeah, yeah. See, the sad thing, Kiru, is even children in the big cities of Nigeria, they don't know their native languages because they live in this very diverse environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that English is what everybody uses to communicate. So they don't know Igbo, they don't know Ana.
Hmm.
And they, and unfortunately, when they're still that age, they don't even think it's important. It's when they come out here to realize that you may speak this English better than a white person,
mm-hmm.
but you are still nothing. Then they're like, oh, so why didn't I learn, you know, this, you know, backbone? Yeah. So some of our children are struggling a lot. My nieces and nephews in Nigeria and elsewhere, they're having the same issues you're talking about. You know, now you are bullied and bullied because you have a name that is not American, you have food that is not American, and you become ashamed, afraid of saying, this is who I am. This is how most high schools, primary schools work worldwide. So it's a difficult thing to grapple with, especially if you are the only Black child, you know, at school. It's difficult. I don't know how we get out of this, but to encourage parents, you know, to pay attention to their children's experiences in, you know, in America. Talk with them a lot, ask them what they are going through, and you can carefully put in a word of affirmation.
Mm.
Because if we are not careful, our kids become ashamed of being African, being Nigerian, being Black. Okay, being Black. But as you've said, and you know, this is very true, we have more resources now.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of people standing up.
Yes.
To say, this is who we are. Take it or leave it.
Mm-hmm.
This is who we are. And it's the same thing with every minority group. African Americans have done this for 400 years, and they're still doing it. Otherwise, they won't get the little liberties they're getting. So, you know, let no one say it's too much. If you don't keep saying you exist, you mm-hmm. can be pushed aside, you can be forgotten, you can be deleted, you can be eliminated. So we are lucky to have a lot of cultural figures. You did mention music a while back. Look at what Nigerian music is doing worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's no way you will not put Nigerian in that description. That's where it's coming from.
Yeah.
Yes. Look at what literature has given Nigerians over time. It's one place we are competing with the best in the world. And in any case, literature promises that no one story is more important than the other.
Yeah.
Okay. So our writers are writing nonstop, And now you have so many Nigerian writers writing, other Africans that are jumping in. So it's available now for people to, you want to read about Rwanda, you read about it. You want to, you Google and know where to go. So it's a good thing, but the challenges are still there because the supremacists are jumping back in and fighting. I don't know. I don't know what to really say except what I have said.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I mean, I think I'll say one good thing, a few things that kind of sprung out at me as you were talking. So I think, again, kind of going back to my own upbringing, for many of us kind of growing up during that time period, our parents, they were just coming to the country. They just wanted to work. They wanted to, the typical immigrant experience, provide a better life for your kids, better than what you had back home growing up. So you just want your kids to assimilate as much as possible to this new culture that they're in, mm-hmm. be successful academically and otherwise. So many, I would say African immigrant parents, and just I think in general across immigrant groups, a lot of times maybe they didn't focus so much on the cultural side of things because again, they're combating so many different things and, reminding people, oh, I'm from this place every time. Most times I would say it serves as more of a challenge than anything. But I think for this next generation, Gen Z, I would say for them growing up, they might not have those same challenges because, their peers are seeing, Africans in a more positive light and, specifically Nigerians, because of course that's the lens that we're primarily speaking from. But, compared to, my own upbringing, my own school experiences, I don't think Gen Z, especially the ones who are like, let's say in their teenage years now, I don't think they will experience the same thing only because, the representation is a lot more present now than it was, when I was coming up. So that's one thing. The other thing too that I wanted to mention that from what you said, like with Nigerian authors and Nigerian musicians and everything else like that. So I think on the same note, like, in as much as we are, Black people from the, the African diaspora, we are still coming from somewhere else. So it's important for us to highlight, those cultural backgrounds as well. So it won't just be, I don't know how to best phrase it. So it won't just be, okay, this is a Black author, and then just kind of lump you in with maybe the African Americans, because our experience is different, obviously. But to emphasize the Nigerian piece or whatever other cultural background that you're coming from. I don't know what you think about that. Does that kind of make sense to you? Or is that what you were saying earlier?
Yes. It makes sense. Let me see whether I understand you. It's very easy for white people to say, okay, these are Black people. Mm-hmm. It may be difficult for them to know this is Igbo, this is Anang, this is a Zambian, this is a South African, this is a UK Black, mm-hmm. it's a Jamaican. So we have to do the job. We have to do the work for ourselves.
Yes.
Yeah. We have to showcase this diversity.
Right.
Yeah, it's very important. And I've just done it in my own little way by writing this book. You can't imagine, Kiri, the number of people who are saying to me, we didn't know that the Anangs exist. And these are Nigerians. And I cannot really blame them because, look, how many of these 250 or 500 tribes in Nigeria do I know? See what I mean?
Yeah.
How many do I know? I do not know the tribes of Northern Nigeria. If they ask me. And so these days when I speak about Nigeria, I'm very limited in what I present as fact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? If we talk about Nigerian food, I'm going to say the food in my part of Nigeria.
Right.
Yeah. You know, if I'm going to talk about Africa, I would be very careful what I say, because I've never been to Namibia. I've been to like 10 African countries out of 54.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we so casually want to speak for Africa. I mean, we should, but we should be very careful so that we do not stand up to present Africa as a country. Because
exactly.
Sometimes this is what we Africans are doing. Mm-hmm. You know, they ask us, oh, you Africans standing there, can you talk about how you, you know, what it means to grow up in Africa?
Exactly.
Is that talking about what it meant for me to grow up in 1970 Anang land? Is it that kind of
mm-hmm. It's very specific, it's very different.
So we have to do the work of, you know, showing how diverse, you know, things, you know, are.
Yeah.
What this will do for us over time, it will humanize us. It will allow us to get away from carrying this huge load of always representing this huge unknown.
Mm-hmm.
So we make one mistake at the workplace. They say, no, these Africans cannot do this. They quickly say, no, this African geek, we brought an African here, he couldn't fit. So because this person could not exist here, it means the whole of Africa failed. You bring a woman in, and you know, women cost us a lot of problems here. Women did not fit in here. So that woman, the whole time she was working there, she was aware that she was carrying this load that if I crash, it's the whole world of women crashing. There's so much, you know, what
is overwhelming. Does,
yeah, overwhelming. The emotional burden you are carrying. You are not only trying to do the work, you are trying to represent, you know, the people who look like you. So there's still a lot of work, you know, to do. I hope that I hope my rambling helps.
Yes. Thank you for that response. And actually, I'm so happy that you mentioned that, the sentiment of people who look like you, because, you know, one thing I found important that you mentioned in the book is, you know, the encounter that Ekong had with his African-American neighbor. And they, when they began to exchange, when the neighbor started to express some anti-African sentiments after they had like a, you know, misunderstanding. And I know this is definitely a common pain point for continental Africans in the diaspora, as well as, you know, of course, our African-American counterparts, which, you know, for generations, this is something that has caused strife and longstanding tensions. But mm-hmm. I think, you know, again, as I always try to kind of bring it back, you know, I think for those of us millennials, particularly for those of us who were born or raised here in the diaspora, this is something that we're making efforts to connect, you know, better with. Like, for example, I think for me, you know, being that I grew up here, you know, and then I always talk about how my dad made sure that we were aware of the historical kind of reference points of, you know, the African American experience. So my appreciation or my understanding or, you know, everything of like African Americans, I would say is a lot different than, let's say, your average African person who just came here recently. So mm-hmm. my sentiments, I guess, would be I'm more inclined to maybe support, you know, African Americans or explain to those who are just coming here, you know, this is the reason why certain things are. So I kind of serve as like, I would say many of us in the diaspora of the millennial generation, we can kind of relate on a different level because we have been exposed to them on a closer level, whether it's in school or, you know, in our other interactions. And also because, again, because of, you know, accents, you know, versus someone who just came here yesterday. So their experiences are different. You know, mine has been closely related to theirs. Someone who just came here recently, they are still thinking in a very, you know, African mindset, whatever that might mean. And, you know, so a lot of time, I think that's where a lot of these tensions come into play. these supposed differences between the two groups, mainly because of misunderstandings. Some are intentional misunderstandings, and some are just because maybe language or accent or just other cultural barriers. So I would like for you to, if you can kind of talk more about that, like what have, you know, your experience or with Ekong's experience in this particular scenario, or just anything else if you wanted to share on that.
Yeah, you know, it's a very important topic. Because when back in Africa, before the age of social media, what did we know about the Black Americans, the African Americans? All we knew about them basically came from movies and novels written about, you know, them, newspapers, and who were the people who owned these outlets? White people.
Exactly.
So we grew up thinking these our Black people in America were not responsible, were not, you know, were violent, were this, were that. That's how these things were presented to us. And it's different now with social media. We get to see things and analyze more, and actually everybody, anybody can put something up and say, look, this is not true. But think about in the 70s or in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Okay. It's the same thing with the Native Americans. What did I know about the Native Americans? All I knew was what I saw in John Wayne movies. You know, this white guy was more powerful than the Native Americans. These Native Americans who were savages, and John Wayne was bringing like civilization to, you know, to them. You see? And Nkiru, nobody could have told me when I lived in Nigeria, or for many years I lived here, that American police could tell lies. You see? I you know, how? I knew it was Nigerian police that told lies, not American police, not British police, you know? So then you get here and you start seeing that the system has made a conscious decision to demonize this demographic, to destroy their credibility, to lock them out of the system. Are we not now talking about how to pass that bill in Congress about the black hair? Can you imagine this? So when I heard this like 2 weeks ago, I was touching my head. Which hair are you talking about? My hair? This is not something I ever thought about in Nigeria. You see? You know, we have to unlearn a lot of things about the African Americans before we can accept them. We have to do the work, okay? They also have to do the work, because what did they know about Africa?
Right.
What they knew was the movie Idi Amin Dada. You see? The gods must be crazy. Tarzan, okay? Tarzan. We are still living on trees. And who made all these movies? Both sides, the African Americans and the Africans, we have to unlearn a lot about each other. And many Africans are taking steps to do this. They do this DNA test, ancestry test, and then you discover that you have a sixth cousin living in living in California. You have a 12th cousin living in Louisiana, and you just came to the U.S. to study for 4 years, and you discover this stuff. It brings the pain of slavery closer, because you realize this, your 12th cousin got here via slavery 200 years ago, 300 years ago, you know. So So some of us are making have gone to meet our distant cousins, and that conversation is very, for the most part, very emotional.
Wow.
That we are one people. We are one people. So there's a lot we have to unlearn. How were women presented in movies in the past? See, we've had to unlearn a lot of this because women are stepping forward to say, no. That thing we can do that job. It's not a problem for us. It's only because you have been stopping us. So there's a lot the world is grappling with right now. Everybody wants to belong. Everybody wants to be treated with dignity. So I'm very happy you're bringing up, this conversation.
Yes, I mean, I think it's definitely a very important and necessary one to have at this time. Just like you said, and actually, what you just told me, what you said just now, is news to me. I didn't realize that Africans were doing that. I thought it was more of African Americans who would be doing the DNA testing to try to connect. So I think that's beautiful to see that Africans are doing that as well. That's, I mean, like you said, I think when people take those steps to find out where those missing gaps are and to connect on a deeper level, it takes away some of those built up barriers that we put up by ourselves, you know, and deliberately or unintentionally misunderstanding one another, and just kind of makes everything like it puts things into perspective. And I think even with, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, when we saw the whole George Floyd, murder in real time, I think for the first time, many African people, continental Africans, both back home and those in the diaspora, they saw for the first time in a very major and a very tangible way that this is not just something that maybe Black Americans are exaggerating or just they want to talk about some type of oppressive history. It's not a history. It's a everyday kind of thing, and it can happen to you. You don't say that because, you know, I'm from Nigeria or I'm from Kenya, I'm from, you know, wherever I am from on the continent, that if a police officer pulls me over, they're going to say, oh, you know, this person is fine. They're not a Black American. They're from, you know, wherever they're from back home, on the continent. So I think, like you said, it puts things into perspective. And I think to kind of switch gears a little bit with this idea of putting things into perspective, I really want to go back to the point of, you know, the story of minorities among minorities. And, you know, as I was talking to you earlier about it, for my mother-in-law, she is from the Ukwani people in the Delta region of Nigeria, who, of course, they were, you know, in the Biafra region as well. So, you know, my husband tells me about, you know, his mom's experience with Igbo people. For her, it's not always like a favorable thing. I don't, you know, of course, that's not my lived experience, so I don't know how to really speak for her. But the perspective that you brought to my attention, you know, in our discussion yesterday was just about how even in your own marginalization, there are also people who are maybe, if you want to say, more marginalized, if that even makes sense. So, I mean, I would love for you to maybe speak a little bit more about that, because that was a really interesting perspective, and you know, I appreciate you for kind of letting me know about that.
Yes, you see, there's something about in the world we are all holding each other's throat, but we don't know we are doing that. So you would see that someone might be very victimized, suffering a lot, but is also dishing out a lot of suffering to the person under him or under her. This is the story of of the world. So, for example, if you look at the Biafran War, from the perspective of the three big tribes, the Igbos, the Yorubas, the House of the Hausas. The Igbos come out as victims, the ultimate victims, because the other two, when the Nigerian, you know, army that was already well established, and the Igbos have to quickly form an army and look for a way to fight, and you know, they were crushed in a very painful, you know, way. But now, if you open the lens a bit wider, and you see that there were 30 minority tribes within, you know, the Biafran enclave, and my book begins to tell the story of what this Biafran army, this Igbo thing, because Biafra is very Igbo, what they did to the minorities, the Niger Delta, it's not a happy story. And many of my Igbo friends are very shocked and are beginning to ask questions. And so, oh, we didn't know about this. But how would you know it? Because your parents were 10 years old when the war was going on. Your parents did not know what your soldiers were doing in minority lands. Okay, you know, so it's important to accept each other. And I hope people can actually sit down and talk about this war. Not brag about it, not insult the other person. What if we were to sit down and say, what happened to your people? And it empowers the other person to say, this is what happened to my people. And then this one can also say, so, okay, what happened to your people? And we talk about, you know, talk about this. It could bring, you know, it could bring healing. It could make us function better as a continent, as a country. Now, this sort of thing is not only restricted to Africa. The Ukrainians and the Russians are as white as they come. They will have to figure out how to relate with each other. War is a human thing. Unfortunately, in the last 100 years, we've been made to feel that, oh, it's only Africans that keep fighting wars. We don't know what is wrong with them. And so when this Ukraine war started, when this painful thing started, you had a lot of journalists, you know, saying, oh, this is Ukraine. This is not just some tribal war. This is not in Africa. This is, the point is, they are human beings. We are human beings. Europe used to fight all kinds of wars. You know, 100 years war, a 30 years war, the war of this, the war of that. We just have to figure out, keep figuring out how to accept each other, how to create a more just world order where everybody feels accepted. What does it mean for the people of your tribe not to have access to education? What does that mean? It means 50 years down the road, your people will not be, you know, sitting in, you know, in board meetings and making decisions. This is what it means. You will, what does it mean to say the children, the girls of Northern Nigeria have to marry once they become adolescent? Age 13, gone. Age 12, gone. What does this mean? And they are going to raise children, children raising children. And then we are shocked that Northern Nigeria is a mess. There are consequences. See, if you allow the girls of Northern Nigeria one generation, you would be surprised how much they can achieve in that one generation of being, you know, in school.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you just allow it, you know, they're dying to go to school, but patriarchy has them by the throat. Yeah, yeah. Has them by the throat.
That's true. I mean, that's a very very good insight that you just gave. I mean, I think like there's just so many gems from this interview, and I really really do want to appreciate you for this time and for what you've shared. And you know, as we round up, if you could just kind of let our listeners know how they can either contact you or buy your books, or just some final closing thoughts, please.
Nkiru, I'm very grateful. I'm very happy with what you are doing, because the desire, the motivation to do this podcast, to set up this podcast where you talk about these kinds of issues, this motivation comes from very deep within you, and you are feeling, I can help my fellow human beings, you know, get closer to each other. So I can't thank you enough for this. You can reach me by writing to my, if you get to my website, womapan.com, you know, you can write a mail to me. You can also buy my books, Amazon and Barnes and Nobles, Books a Million. There are so many places. My website. If I've left anyone out, please don't be offended. my website has, when you click on my two books, they'll take you to where you can buy them. Yeah, local bookstores as well. My book has just been published in Nigeria. That information is on my Facebook page. I'll soon put that on my website. Anyway, Nkiru, thank you very much. And I hope we talk again.
Yes, we definitely will. And just maybe one word for those aspiring authors from the diaspora, either here or back home, maybe some words of encouragement on how they can tell their own stories.
Yes, nobody can do it for you. It's a daunting process, but it begins with that discomfort, that desire within you to tell your story. Work very hard on it. Push your writing. Never lose hope. But most importantly, never lose your humanity. If you don't succeed at the end of the day, there are other gifts God has given you. So there's no reason to be bitter. Art has a way of twisting the artist. If you become an artist and you become less human, more, you know, angry, pained, because you couldn't write a book, because you couldn't write a story, that dream did not come true for you. There are other gifts God has given you. I always encourage my students, explore, work very hard, develop your writing, skills. You believe you can do it? Well, go for it. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. You are still a beautiful human being, a brilliant chap, a brilliant girl, a wonderful human being, though you couldn't write, but you don't know yet that you cannot do that. You don't know yet how it will work out. So why don't you take that, go on that journey and figure it out. Is that encouraging enough?
Yes, I think it is.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Mr. Uwem. And to our listeners, thank you so much for listening and for tuning in. This is Conversations from the Diaspora, a Building Africa's Future podcast. And until next time, be well. Bye.
Thank you.